The Book of Judges, Uncensored, Episode 9. Yesterday we started discussing the story of Shimshon and wanted to go back to a few points that we spoke about yesterday and clarify them a little bit better. The first thing we spoke, one of the things we spoke about with Shimshon was there's a story when he goes to marry a woman, a Philistine woman from Timnah, right? So on his way there, it says that...
Wait, Shimshon, the guy with the long hair.
Yeah, that's Shimshon with the guy with the long hair. It says that when he was on his way to Timnah to go marry her, so if you look closely at the pasuk, it says, and this is in Perek Yud Dalet, pasuk Hey, so it says, "Vayered Shimshon va'aviv v'imay Timnasa." Shimshon and his father and his mother went to Timnah, and then as he was going, "Vayavo ad Karmei Timnasa," they went up to the vineyards of Timnah, and then there was a lion that came towards Shimshon, seemingly to attack him, right? And then we said this whole story that he was able to defeat the lion. He ripped it up and he left the carcass over there on the side of the road, and he didn't tell his parents about it. And then the next time he went back, when he was on his way to marrying the girl from Timnah, so he sees honey inside a beehive inside the lion's carcass, and he takes some of the honey and he eats it and he gives it to his parents, etc. But he didn't tell them where he got the honey from, right? So
a beehive
inside the lion's carcass. Yeah, we spoke about this yesterday at great length. Okay, now if you look closely, it says that Shimshon and his mother and father were going to Timnah, right? And then it says the lion came and only attacked him. So what happened to his parents? And then if he was going with his parents to Timnah, so then why weren't they aware of this whole story about the lion both times? Like, he was going together with them. So when I was going over this story last night with one of my sons, so I came across another detail that I forgot to mention. That detail is that it says Vayavo ad Karmei Timnah. So they came up to the vineyard of Timnah, right? So the Mefarshim explained that means that what happened was they split ways. Shimshon and his parents split ways when they got to the vineyard. Shimshon's parents walked through the vineyard to get to Timnah, because that's the closest way to get there. But Shimshon himself didn't want to walk through the vineyard, because as a Nazir, he's not allowed to drink wine. And we said yesterday, he's also not even allowed to eat grapes. And so, and we said that the whole idea of a Nazir is to distance himself from sin. So Shimshon didn't even want to walk through the vineyard, which might technically be permitted, but he wanted to keep himself away from sin. So instead of going through the vineyard, he went around the vineyard, and then that's when this whole story with the lion happened. So he was going with his parents, but then they sort of split so that he can go around the vineyard, and then he met the lion, right? And then he joined up with his parents again. And then the second journey also, the same thing happened. He split off from his parents to check on this carcass, and he saw the honey over there. And then when he rejoined them, he brought them the honey. Right. So that's a point over here.
Did he carry the honey in?
So there's a Chazal tell us. Chazal have this expression that when they talk about a person that a person should try to stay away from sin, so we say lech lech amrinan the nazira. We say go sechor sechor, go around the karma leistikrav, don't come close to the vineyard. So this is like taking that expression to like its literal conclusion of a nazir not actually going through a vineyard. Okay, that's one point that was relevant to yesterday's shir. The other point was we spoke about the Gemara Nedarim on Daf Tesamud Aleph, where we said that Shimon HaTzadik didn't want to eat from the sacrifices of any Nazir, because he felt that most people who become a Nazir are somewhat insincere, and they're only doing it, you know, for their self-aggrandization, and they weren't doing it with proper intentions. Until he came across the story of the guy who saw a reflection of himself in the river, and that reflection sort of, seeing his own reflection, pushed him towards doing a certain Avera, whatever exactly that Avera was, whether it was sexual in nature or idolatrous in nature, but he wanted to do some sort of Avera because he saw his reflection, so he decided he's going to become a Nazir. So the way I explained the Gemara yesterday was that he decided he's going to become a Nazir, and his hair is going to get all long and disheveled, and he's going to look ugly, and then he won't be swayed towards doing whatever Avera it was. But and then all you guys were arguing and saying, "What do you mean, a guy with long hair? Who said that's ugly? And who said that would dissuade him from doing Averas?" So if you look closely in the Gemara, and I looked closely again earlier, it was last night, I looked closely at the Gemara again, so it seems that I said it over slightly inaccurate. Really, what it was is he said that he'll become a Nazir, so that way, when he finishes his term of Nazirus, he'll have to cut off all his hair. And then he'll be ugly or whatever, he won't have this physical temptation to do whatever Avera was that he was going to do. It wasn't the fact that he would have long, disheveled hair that would dissuade him, but it would be the fact that he would have to cut off his hair. So that's a slightly different way of reading the Gemara.
Cut off all the hair, including their pants?
I don't remember what the halacha is. I know that a Mitzora, when he gets his hair cut at the end of his term, he has to get all his hair cut, even his payas. I don't remember what the halacha is by Nazir. I think that might be the same thing, though. I'm not sure. Don't quote me on it. So it's a slightly, it's a different reading of the Gemara. The Gemara wasn't saying that he wanted to get his hair longer. Becoming a Nazir was the means of forcing himself to have to shave off his hair. But anyways, so what happened yesterday was that he married this lady from Timna, and he made a bet with a bunch of Philistine guys at the wedding that they wouldn't be able to figure out his riddle. He asked them a riddle about when from the eater comes the food, and from something strong comes something sweet, which refers back to this story with the lion and the beehive inside the lion. And they weren't able to figure it out. They put pressure on his wife, and they were able to get the answer. And basically, he accused his wife of being unfaithful to him, and he left her.
A bet.
Well, the assumption is, I mean, either it was unfaithful just in terms of the bet, or it was unfaithful in terms of, you know, the reason why she revealed the information to him was because she might have been having an affair with one of these guys. And then in the end, he sort of is estranged from her, and he goes off, and he's not with her anymore, and her father marries her off to somebody else. He goes back, and he wants to reunite with his wife, but her father had married her off to somebody else, so he gets all upset, and he starts going on a rampage, and then he goes on a few different rampages. What?
He's like really strong, right?
Yes, he's very strong. And so we have different stories where he fought them. He killed a bunch. He destroyed a lot of the Philistine fields by putting torches on the tails of foxes. What's the plural of fox? Foxen or foxes?
Foxes.
Foxes. It's not like ox and oxen. Or box and boxen.
I've heard this. You know, is that taken from that comedian?
It could be. I don't know.
If it's short and shvar, it should be bort and shvar.
That's right. So anyway, then there's a whole story where he kills 1,000 Philistines with a donkey's jawbone. Okay. And then he got very thirsty, and Hashem made a nace that was able to get water. I'm saying in very brief bullet points what we spoke about yesterday. Okay. Now, at the end of yesterday, we said the final pasuk of Perek Tezvav, it says Vayishpat es Yisrael b'yimei Plishtim Esrim Shana, and Shimshon judged the Jewish people in the times of the Plishtim for 20 years. Now, in the formula of the way the other parts of Sefer Shoftim are structured, so this verse would be at the end of every Shofet. At the end of every Shofet, it sort of sums up who this guy was by saying, oh, he judged the Jewish people for such and such amount of years, right? So by Shimshon, it says it over here, but this is not the end of the story. The story of Shimshon is going to continue. But you see from the fact that the Navi sort of pretends as if it's ending the story over here and saying how many years he was a Shofet, that this is a break in the story. And here it's going to go off in a completely different direction. So from here onwards, it's sort of a different story. Okay, so that's Shimshon was the Shofet of over Klal Yisrael for 20 years. I saw something very interesting in the Maral earlier today. The Yaakov Avinu, when Yaakov Avinu was giving brachas to his 12 sons before he died, so he gave a bracha to Dan, and he said to Dan, Dan yadin amai ke'achad shiftei Yisrael. Dan shall judge his nation like one of the tribes of Israel. We're going to speak about this more later today, and then probably a lot more even tomorrow and tomorrow's year. But this will be Dan will judge his nation like one of the tribes of Israel. Rashi and Chazal explain that this is a reference to Shimshon. Okay, this is a reference to Shimshon. We'll get more into the details of exactly how you know it's a reference to Shimshon and in what ways it's talking about Shimshon, but it's a reference to Shimshon. So the Maral explains, how do you understand this pasuk? Don Yadin Amai, Don shall judge his nation, meaning Shimshon will be a judge over the Jewish people. Ke'achad Shiftei Yisrael. The Achad over here, there's a difference between the word Echad and the word Achad. The word Echad means one, like the number one, right? The word Achad means the one, with the definite article, a certain one, like a specific one. So the Maral says that this is a reference to Hashem. Hashem is the quintessential one. Shai Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Right? Hashem is the quintessential one. And what it's saying is that Shimshon was a judge over the Jewish people, like Hashem. Just like Hashem is a judge, Shimshon was a judge. And this harkens back to what we spoke about yesterday, that the Gemara says that Shimshon is called Shimshon because the name Shimshon comes from the word Shemesh, and Shemesh is either a name for Hashem, or the Gemara in the Maskana says it's a description of Hashem, and so therefore Shimshon is called Shemesh. It says about Hashem, Ki Shemesh u'magen Hashem elikim. Right? Hashem is like a Shemesh, like a sun, and a magen, and like a shield. Right? So Shimshon's name, the Gemara says, Shimshon's name alludes to his connection or his comparison to Hashem. So the Maral explains what that means. He says that when it comes to din, so when you're doing din, there's only one din. There's only one halacha. There can't be multiple dins, because if there's multiple judgments, if there's multiple ways of judging, so then it's not just anymore. It has to be just. There has to be justice. Right? If there's more than one way, if you have, let's say, the same case, right? And if the same case comes in front of the judge, and in the first time it comes in front of him, he rules one way, and the second time the exact same sort of case comes, he rules a different way. So it's not just. It's not really justice anymore. It's not a real judgment. He's going like this and like this. There's two. It's not one. It has to be one unified way of judging. So he says that just like when Hashem judges the Jewish people, Hashem has one way of doing it, and justice is something that's never changing. It's always remains the same. So too, Shimshon also, he always, when he judged the Jewish people, he also strove to, you know, remain in that in one way of looking at it, without, you know, playing favorites or, you know, judging like this or judging like that in a more wavy or relativistic way. That's the Maral says.
What's the pshat in Shiftei Yisrael? Like the God of Shiftei Yisrael.
Let's like hold on to that thought for a second. And so the Maral doesn't say this explicitly, but I think that this is the connection to the sun, right? As opposed to the moon. The sun is one constant thing. It's the exact same sun every single day, right? As opposed to the moon waxes and wanes, so it's like different. Each day the moon looks different, but the sun it doesn't change, right? So that represents the idea of din that doesn't change. Rachamim is something where it's more pliable, it's more bendable, depending on the situation and depending on who you're talking about and this and that, whatever. You can have rachamim, you can have mercy or clemency. But when it's coming to like the letter of the law, the letter of the law doesn't change in that way. So you asked, okay, so how do you understand Ka'achad Shiftei Yisrael? So Ka'achad Shiftei Yisrael means that Hashem is the one who unifies the different tribes of Klal Yisrael. Vayhi Bishurin Melech B'Sasev Rosh Ha'am. There will be in Yishurin is another name for Klal Yisrael, Yishurin is another for Yisrael. Vayhi Bishurin Melech, there will be a king in Yishurin B'Sasev Rosh Ha'am. When all of the Rosh Ha'am join together. So when all the Jewish people join together, then that brings out the glory of the Malchus of Hashem. So that's what it means. Hashem is sort of like the flagpole, or the flag that everyone rallies around. All the tribes of Israel rally around Hashem. So that's the Ke'achad Shiftei Yisrael. It's the one thing that unites everyone. Fine, now I think we're ready to start Perek Tezayin. Back to Zion, again, we spoke about yesterday how Shimshon had a special bracha with his male organ, and that means that he had a very strong libido and stronger taivas in the sexual realm, more than the average person. And that means that he has a lot of potential if he can overcome those taivas, he has a lot of potential to become a very important person and to be a very strong person, as we said yesterday, that Ezo Gibor Kovish Yisro. So let's see what happens with Shimshon next. Who is a strong man? Who is a Gibor, strong person? A Kovish Yisro, a person who conquers his Yetzer Hara. That's what the real strength is. Okay, so let's see what happens with Shimshon. Pasuk says, Perek Tzayin, says that Shimshon goes, all of a sudden, out of the blue, Shimshon goes to Gaza. Shimshon goes down to Gaza, right? You know why we call it, in English, we call it Gaza, but in Hebrew it's called Gaza. You know why that is? So I'll tell you why.
Over here it says Azasa.
Right, Azasa means to Gaza. If you add there's a rule in the Hebrew language that if you add a hey to the end of a place name, so then it's the same thing as if you added a lamed to the beginning of it. So we would say like Vayelech Shimshon le'aza. So instead of saying le'aza, it says azasa. Like you have in Chumash, you have like there's le'mitzrayim or mitzrayim. It means the same thing. So Shimshon goes to okay. So Gaza is a, so why do we have why do we call it Gaza instead of Gaza? So the answer is it comes from the Greek translation of the Torah. So if you would translate, you don't translate proper names of people or places really. Right? You sort of try to transliterate it, and the letter Ayin.
But you're meant to.
What? Yeah, you don't really. Like you don't translate a name like you have a guy named Baruch, so you're not gonna like, well, I have my friend Baruch. Instead of saying like my friend Baruch, I say my friend Blessing, right? Because I'm speaking in English, I'm not speaking in Hebrew, so you don't translate his name. You just call his name is his name, right? So if you're translating the Torah and like let's say or the Tanakh and it uses the word Aza, right? So if you're translating it to Greek, you're not gonna write. You're not gonna write. I don't know. Aza means like the bold place, right? Aza is like bold or daring, right? So you're not gonna show that. And you know, he went to Avimelech was the king of Grar, and he lived in the bold place. No, that's not how you do it. You just write Aza in Greek, right? But the way to transliterate it, the letter Ayin. So we pronounce Ayin and Aleph as if they're pronounced the same, but it's not really true. And Ayin is really pronounced something like an Ong. Something like that, right? Which could be possibly transliterated as like a G sound, like anga, like something like that, like anga, like something like in that way, like gaza, yeah. So that because of that, when they translated the Tanakh, let's say into Greek, so it got a G sound in the beginning of the name Aza. So because of that, Aza is called Gaza, and you have like Sodom and Gomorrah. Which in the Chumash is Sodom the Amora, but there you have the same thing. The Amora has the ayin, so the ayin becomes like a G sound. So the Sodom and Gomorrah, like Gomorrah, like something like that. Yeah, have it in a few other places also. Okay, so Shimshon goes to Gaza, and he sees there an Isha Zona, which usually means a prostitute. The Radak here for some reason says that it means an innkeeper, but most of the commentators understand that it means a prostitute, and in the context it makes a lot more sense to say that she was a prostitute. And he sees a prostitute woman there, and he has relations with her. Okay? And the people in Gaza find out, hey, Shimshon is here, in our city of Gaza, right, in the middle of Philistine territory. Gaza, we said before, is one of the five Philistine cities. Gaza, Gas, Ekron, Ashdod, and Ashkelon, the five Philistine cities, the five major Philistine cities. So, Shimshon is here, that great Jewish warrior who's been picking off a lot of the Philistine people. So they said, let's wait for him, we'll make a trap, we'll wait the whole night, and in the morning he's probably going to leave the city, because the city has a wall around it, and you can't leave the city without walking through the gate of the city. So he's going to have to go through the gate of the city tomorrow morning. So we'll wait the whole night. And then tomorrow morning when he goes to leave the city, we'll go kill him. We'll make a trap and we'll kill him. Right? Okay, so what happens? It says that Shimshon sleeps until Chatzos HaLaila, till the middle of the night. And he wakes up in the middle of the night. And interestingly, the Rokach says that this was Leil Pesach. This middle of the night where Shimshon wakes up in the middle of the night. He goes to the gate to the city. He grabs the doors to the gate of the city, right? And he just like lifts them off with his with the bolt that closes it, lifts them off, puts them on his shoulder. This is the gates to the city, and he just walks off with it and goes and brings it to Hebron. Very interesting. Gemara says, that the doors to the gates of the city of Aza were at least 60 amos wide. Okay? The doors to the gates of Aza were at least 60 amos wide. And, okay, the number 60 is usually a number of exaggeration in the Gemara. But what you're saying, what we're saying here is, like, we're trying to bring out the point that what Shimshon did over here is quite amazing. He just went, like, ripped off the doors of the city in the middle of the night, put them on his shoulder, and left. You know, they were the people of Aza, the Philistines there, were so sure that he wouldn't be able to get out of the city without having to go through the gate. They decided, you know, we're going to delay doing anything about him till the morning, and then when they open the gates in the morning, we'll capture it. We'll set up a trap and kill him. And they hadn't realized that he's so strong. He just, like, pick off the door and walk off with it.
Look, if he could do that, there's really nothing that he could do to stop him.
It's true.
Didn't they, like, I don't know if you mentioned this or not, but didn't, like, Shimshon at one point, like, pick up two mountains and, like, crush them together?
Yeah, I didn't mention this, but there is a Gemara that says, the Pasuk says, From Tzara to Eshtael. And the Gemara says that Tzara and Eshtael are the names of two mountains which Shimshon picked up and smashed together. So yeah, there's such a Gemara. There, now we mentioned it. Fine, so this is one story. He goes to Aza and he consorts with a prostitute there, and he leaves the city unscathed, even though they were planning against him. So this is the second Philistine woman that Shimshon got involved with. The first one was from yesterday, the lady from Timnah, and now today we have another lady from Aza. As the Malbim says, that Avera Gerer is Avera. There's this concept that when a person does an Avera, so it's going to drag him along and bring him to committing another Avera, and then another Avera, and another Avera. He gets into this vicious cycle of doing the wrong thing until he has to do something to break himself out of this cycle.
The Malbim is Achron or Rishon? Or what is Malbim?
The Malbim died about 120 years ago. So he is an Achron, but his style and the way a lot of people treat him is as if he lived, you know, hundreds of years ago. It's an interesting phenomenon. Not many people are, you know, distinguished in that way. Not many commentators are distinguished in that way, that they live so recently but are treated as if they lived a long time ago. I think they said from, I think I heard from, Rav Nechemia Kaplan, who is the son-in-law of David Soloveitchik, he said in the name of Rav Chaim Brisker that the Malbim was written with Ruach HaKodesh, which is quite, you know, that's quite an achievement for something that was for somebody who lived 100 years ago. Mm. We're not talking about like a Rishon, but the Malbim is taken very seriously.
Still had Ruach HaKodesh 100 years ago?
I think we still have Ruach HaKodesh now, but there's different degrees of Ruach HaKodesh, and there's different ways that the Ruach HaKodesh manifests itself. I don't know. It's not like a light switch. It's either yes or no. It's, you know, it's more shades of gray. How many shades of gray?
Enough to keep us learning Torah.
Very good. Now, it says that we just had the story of Shimshon consorting with a prostitute in Aza. Okay. Now the next story is that he falls in love with a woman in Nachal Sorek named Delilah. And the way the Pasuk introduces it says, Vayhi Achreichen. And it was afterwards, Vayahav Isha Benachal Sarek Ushma Delilah. And he loved the woman in Nachal Sarek, and her name was Delilah. So the Malbim says that this connecting phrase, Vayhi Achreichen, and it was afterwards, suggests that this story of him falling in love with the woman Delilah in Nachal Sarek is connected to him visiting a prostitute in Aza. So that's where he says this idea of, oh, it must be that they're somehow connected, that Avera Gerer is Avera. That he did, and that Shimshon did in Aza, is connected to what he's gonna, with this whole story with him and Dalila. Now, you guys might be familiar with the story of Shimshon and Dalila, but there is a little known opinion that says that Dalila was actually Jewish. There's such an opinion that Dalila was a Jewish woman, not a Philistine woman. From the Psukim itself, you're not gonna see proof either way, really. But from Chazal, it seems to be that Dalila was actually a Philistine. The Tosefta de Targum says that Dalila was Jewish. She was the mother of Micha, a guy who had a pestle, an idol for idolatry. But Rashi, in the story of Pestel Micha, disagrees with that Tosefta de Targum, and he says no, Dalila was not the mother of Micha. But there is an opinion that says that Dalila was Jewish. But the mainstream opinion is more that Dalila was not Jewish. So yesterday we spoke Barichus about the Rambam, who says that all the women that Shimshon was with converted to Judaism. So that was what we spoke about yesterday. So the Rambam says it in plural, but it could be the Rambam was talking about the woman from Timna and the woman from Azza, but the woman from Dalila, but Dalila maybe he would say was Jewish. The Rambam doesn't explicitly talk about, you know, which women was he talking about. He doesn't divide it in that way. So he said, it says in the pasuk that this woman Dalila is from Nachal Sorek. Okay, the word Sorek is spelled Sin Vav Resh Kuf, and Chazal say that the word Sorek Sin Vav Resh Kuf is related to the word Sorek or Srak, which is Samach Resh Kuf, which means a barren tree, a non-fruit bearing tree. Ilan Sorek or Ilan Srak is a tree that doesn't give fruits. Bereishis Rabbah, Bamidbar Rabbah, Parsha Tes, that says that at this point, Shimshon is like an Ilan Srak. He's like a non-fruit-bearing tree, because we see that he's becoming so accustomed to doing averas and not doing mitzvahs, so he's like a tree that doesn't give fruits. We know that fruits are a remez to the mitzvahs that a tzaddik does. Like we say, tzaddik ha-tamar yifrach. Right? A tzaddik sprouts like a tamar, like a date tree. He gives off fruit. The deeds that a tzaddik does are the fruits that a tzaddik does. So when a person is not doing mitzvahs or he's doing averas, so he's like a barren tree that's not giving off fruit. That's a Chazal make this exegesis on the word nachal sarik. They also say that at this point,
what's the exact difference of exegesis?
I once saw a t-shirt that said Jews for exegesis. Midrash, drush.
Drush.
Yeah.
A diuk or something?
Yeah, like it's sort of like a diuk. The Medrash also mentions that now that the Shimshon is doing his avera threefold, because he had the woman in Timna, and then the woman in Azza, and now Dalila, so he's sinned three times, he's like a muad for doing averas. He's like a muad. Like, you know, we have like a halacha that an ox, so the first two or three times that it gores, so it's called a tam, you only have to pay half the damages. But then after the third time or on the third time, yeah, it becomes a muad. It becomes it becomes expected to gore, and then we don't give you a break. We make you pay the full damages. We don't say pay half. So now Shimshon, the Medrash says Shimshon is like a muad because he's sinning three times. Okay, so what happens with Dalila? So it says that the Sarnei Plishtim, the Plishti noblemen, come to Dalila and they say to her, "We want you to convince Shimshon and find out how he had, what is the source of his powers? What's his weak spot? And we want to be able to tie him up and to make him suffer. And we will give you, we're offering you, each of us is offering you 1,100 silver slum. That's how much we're going to give you. Each of us is going to give you 1,100 silver slum. A sella is a type of currency.
One, a couple shekels back when the shekels worth money, huh?
1,100 sella. That's how much we're offering her. So that's what they offered her, to find out what the source of Shimshon's powers are and reveal it to them so that they can capture Shimshon and he won't be a threat to the Philistines anymore. Okay, now you guys are probably familiar with this story, so we don't have to like really go into the mamish all the details. But two points to keep in mind in this story are, as the Radak says, that this story, each episode in this story, didn't happen right after the other. It took a long time for this whole thing to happen. Right? So it's, to us, it seems like obvious and apparent what's happening over here. But to Shimshon, it wasn't so obvious. Otherwise, if you read the story, Shimshon is going to look like an idiot or a naive person that he doesn't realize what's going on. We realize what's going on because the story is presented as one long narrative. But for Shimshon, it was protracted over a long period of time, so it wasn't so obvious what was happening. That's one point. The second point is that it seems, and my friend Arnie Wittenstein points this out, that it seems that throughout this entire period, Shimshon was always getting into fights with Plishtim and just like killing random Plishtim here and there, fighting with them, and them coming and trying to hurt him, and him turning into the Hulk and defeating them and whatever. It was an ongoing thing. Okay, those are two points to keep in mind. So Delilah says to Shimshon, she says to him, "Tell me, what is the source of your great powers? If I wanted to, let's say, tie you up or lock you up, right, how would I be able to do that?" It's a very innocent question. No, in a way it is, because the way women are, so women feel like if you reveal to them your vulnerabilities, so then that means that we're so close that you're willing to tell me like your deepest secrets. So like, even if she wasn't trying to like figure it out so that she could tell the Plishtim, it's not so far-fetched that she would try to try to understand him better, try to get his deepest secrets, so that would like sort of build their relationship. She would feel like it's building their relationship. So like, you wouldn't, if I was in Shimshon's place, I wouldn't necessarily suspect that she's working with the Plishtim to try to do something to me. Especially if Delilah was Jewish, which again is a minority opinion, but is a valid opinion. If she was a Philistine, then okay, you might be more suspicious, especially in light of yesterday that we had all these. The lesson of yesterday's episode was don't trust the Philistines, because they're not loyal, they're not faithful. Okay, so Shimshon says to her that. Shimshon says to her that if you tie me up in 7 ropes that are still wet, that were never dried, so then I'll become weak. I'll be like any other person, and you would be able to defeat me. Okay? So what happens? At some point later on, when Shimshon gets into another fight with the Plishtim, so they come along armed with 7 wet ropes that had never been dried, and they tied him around with it.
Is it ropes?
I'm sorry. One second. No, the Philistine noblemen came and they brought Shimshon's. I don't know. If, it doesn't say that he married her. His friend, girlfriend, let's say. They brought her these 7 ropes, and she tied him around with it, and then they set up a trap, and she would they were doing this like naturally, like in the house, as if they were just playing around or something. And then all of a sudden, the policemen would like storm the house, and then she says, "Ah, the policemen are coming! The policemen are coming!" And what does he do? He flexes his muscles, and these ropes just like melt away. Okay, so that showed that that's not the secret to Shimshon's power. Right? So she says, "No, you're making a fool of me. You lied to me. No, really, really. Tell me how is it that you can get bound up?"
You
and again,
believe her after this?
No. Again, let's say this happened like 3 or 4 years later. It's like you're not connecting all these events, right? If it was a common thing that Plishtim would come and start a fight with Shimshon, or Shimshon would start a fight with her, with Plishtim, so like, okay, it happened to be that she put me down to these ropes, and it happens to be that at that moment the Plishtim came, but like, why would you put the 2 and 2 together? Why would he necessarily be so suspicious? Right, so again, he tells her that if you would bind me with brand new ropes that have never been used for anything else, so then again I would become weak and I'll be like any other person and I would lose my powers. Okay, so she brought, this time it wasn't the Plishti officers or the Plishti noblemen that brought it to her, she had to do it herself because the Plishti were already getting suspicious of her, so she had to bring the ropes herself. And she's very nonchalantly tying him up in a friendly manner or whatever, and then all of a sudden the Plishti pop out of nowhere and she said, oh Shimshon, the Plishti are coming. And then again, he just snaps away the ropes and frees himself. So she says, yeah. Again, why don't you tell me what's going on? What's the real way to tie you up? Why are you lying to me? Right? Again, the whole story could be taking years and years. So it's not like he wouldn't necessarily connect these episodes. So he tells her at a different point. He says, if you take 7 locks of my hair. Yeah, and you put a weaving rod into it. Yeah, that they use for weaving, like a stick to weave. So then then you'd be able to subdue me. So Shitaka did that. She put this thing in his hair. She put the pegs of the loom in his hair, and Plishtim came, and this time he was actually sleeping. Like he woke up, and he just tore it out of his hair, and he was able to save himself from the Plishtim this time. Okay. This is already getting repetitive, right? But the punchline is always the punchline is always on the fourth one.
Right? Really?
What?
They're usually on the third.
Okay. So she says to him, please, really, really tell me, how could you claim that you love me if you're not even revealing to me what's deep in your heart and what are the sources of your power? You're just making a joke out of me. You're not really confiding in me, and you're not really sharing your deepest vulnerabilities with me. How could you claim that you love me? And it says, it was when she was tormenting him with her words for many days. She put pressure on him. He felt like he wanted to die. So Rashi says, what does it mean over here? Rashi says that the word vata'altsehu, it means she pushed him or she pressured him. Ve'en lo dimyon. It doesn't have any counterpart in all of Tanakh. There's no, this shirish doesn't really appear in the rest of Tanakh. So it's a unique word. Somewhat unique word. What?
I think that's the...
What?
Don't worry about it.
Okay. So what he's thinking about is the Gemara that explains how she put pressure on Shimshon. The Gemara says... What? The Gemara says that the way she would put pressure on him to reveal the information about where his weak spot is was that while they were engaged in intimacy, in the heat of the moment, in the throes of passion, as they were about to reach the climax of their engagement, she would suddenly slip out from underneath him, and she would ask him again, what's the source of your power? Under the pressure of that moment to try to get him to say what's the source of his power. And he felt like he wanted to die because it was a lot of pressure on him. And as the Pasuk tells us, eventually he told us what was in his heart. And he told her the reason, Moira loy ola al reishi, a razor had never been put upon my head, ki nazir lekim ani mi beten imi, for I am a nazir of Hashem from the stomach of my mother. Im gulachti, if I would get a haircut, v'sar mi meni koichi, then my powers would be removed from me, my strength would be removed from me, v'chalisi, and I would become sick, v'yisi k'chol hadam, or relatively compared to his great strength now, he would be considered weak and sickly, v'hayisi k'chol hadam, I'll be like any person. So now he revealed his weak spot, his secret. V'atera delila ki higidla es kolibay. Delila realized, okay, this is the real deal, this is the truth. Right? How did she realize it? How did she know that this time he wasn't lying? Fool me once, fool me twice, fool me three times, fool me four times. Shame on who?
What do you say in the town?
How did she realize? It says here
that
she
had really long hair.
What?
If she had really long hair, maybe she was like, "Whoa, that actually."
So
it seems like she was just taking any information she got and reporting.
No, but here the pasuk says like, and she saw that he actually said the truth, like as if it's like, okay, now she really
differently than before.
The simplest way I think is to say what you're saying, that like he didn't just tell her like, oh, you know, if you do like some random thing, so they'll make me weak. No, he gave like a logical explanation to it. It's like, oh, because I'm a Nazir, so that's why I have this karkas, that's why I have the long hair. It's like, ah, now it makes a little bit more sense. He offered a rationalization besides just saying, you know, what you could do to weaken me. He said why it works. Okay, that's one way. The Gemara in Maseches Sota and Daf Tes Amid Beis gives two other ways of understanding how she knew that it was the truth. One way, the Gemara says, because the Divrei Emes Nikarim, when you're confronted with the truth, it's like, it's clear, it's obvious that that's the truth. That's an interesting idea. When you see the truth, you know that you're seeing the truth. The other idea the Gemara says is because he said in his explanation, because I am a Nazir of Hashem from the stomach of my mother. He said the phrase Nazir Elikim. I'm saying Elikim. But he didn't say Elikim. He said hello, you know, and then him, right? He said Hashem's name. And she reasoned that I know Shimshon, I know he's a big tzaddik. And he wouldn't say Hashem's name for no reason unless it was true. So from the fact that he said Nazir Elikim Ani, that's how she knew it was true. That's what the Gemara says. So what does she do? She calls, she sends a secret message to her Philistine handlers, and she tells them, okay, this time he told me the truth, he told me how to weaken him. And the Philistines came over to the house with the money, and they're ready to pay her up, and they're ready to take down Shimshon. So what does she do? She puts him to sleep on her lap. Yeah, on her knees or whatever. It says al birkeha. Article translated as on her knees. Well, I guess knees and lap is really the same thing, anyways, right? Okay, so she puts him to sleep on her lap, and she called over these Philistine guys, and they gave him a haircut while he was sleeping.
Now, halachically, if the Nazir gets a haircut against his will, then he's not, then he has to start over.
I don't know. It's an interesting question. I think so.
I would think not.
Yeah?
I mean, it's like, if it's something that he's done, like, I mean...
No, he doesn't. First of all, you don't have to restart your Naziris unless you become Tameh. If you violate the other halachas of Naziris, you did an Isser, but it doesn't mess up your Naziris. Only if you become Tamei. Now, the question is, if you become Tamei Ba'onis, do you have to restart? And I think the halacha is that yes. Because Lamaisa, you became Tamei. Does that answer your question, Shlomi?
No. I'm just wondering if this is considered a violation on his part of the Naziris, the fact that they cut it. Meaning, so I thought you could bring evidence from whether or not you would have to be certain zeros, but apparently it's not relevant anyways, because you know, the person
who No. Haircutting and drinking wine doesn't make you restart the Nazirs.
Them cutting his hair, is that making him not a Nazir technically?
Okay, so let's see a little bit more in the story, and then we're going to consider exactly how the mechanics of how some of these things over here are working. Okay, so it says that they shaved off 7 locks of his head, and then they were able to subdue him, and she screams out, "Oh, Shimshon, the plishim are here!" And he suddenly wakes up from his sleep, and he's like, "Okay, I'm going to go out and fight them like always." But then he didn't realize that Ki Hashem sar me'olav. Hashem had departed away from him. Hashem left him. He didn't have that extra strength. He wasn't able to turn into the Hulk again. Okay? And the plishim grabbed him, and they poked out his eyes. It's quite brutal. They poked out his eyes, and they brought him down to Aza, and they locked him up in chains, and they had him working as a grinding over there in the jail. Like, you know, they make you work when you're in jail. So what they had him doing was, because he's, I guess, still a strong guy in some ways, they had him grinding with the millstone. Okay. So there's a few different questions over here. First of all, what's like some sort of kryptonite? Shimshon has like kryptonite, like if you cut his hair, so he loses his powers, like Superman? But like the kryptonite affects him?
I don't think it was actually much to do with his hair, though.
Yeah, what do you want to say this?
I mentioned Hashem departed from
him. Yeah. So it doesn't really, the way we understand the story when we're little kids, we understand it like sort of simplistically that like, well, if he has long hair, he has, you know, these extra powers, and when he doesn't have long hair, he loses it. But it doesn't really have to do with the long hair. It really has to do with, is Hashem with him or is Hashem not with him?
Why does it mention his hair grew back a little
bit? One second, we'll get to that. So, I don't know. There's a medrash that says in Bamidbar Rabbah Parsha Dalet, it says that Al Shatime Atzmei Begoya He Garmolei Lois a Giloch, because he defiled himself by living with a non-Jewish woman, which seems to be talking about Delila. So again, like that's Chazal's opinion that she was not Jewish, as opposed to Tosefta the Targum that she was Jewish. So because he defiled himself by living with a Goya, so she ended up cutting off his hair. And that was sort of the beginning of his downfall. But is it the hair itself gives him the power, or is it sort of what Shlomi was trying to get to, like keeping the halachas, keep following the commandments of Hashem? That's what has the power. Being a tzaddik, or now you have Hashem with you, so there you have the power. When you don't have Hashem with you, then you lose the power.
But how was he a tzaddik the first three times?
What?
How was he a tzaddik the first three times?
What do you mean?
He was still with Delilah.
He was still with her. So that could be because even when a person is doing averas, so Hashem doesn't always punish him right away. Hashem gives him time to do tshuva, right? So all the other times he still had his strength, even if he was doing the wrong thing, because Hashem is giving him a chance to do tshuva, and now he's sort of he revealed his secret, and maybe Shlomo is right. Maybe by telling her his secret, he's sort of inviting her to actually cut off his hair. So in a way, he himself was in a way leading to the violation of his nazirus. Maybe that's how to look at it. I don't know. It's something to think about. So it says that they poked out his eyes. We'll speak more about the significance of poking out his eyes towards the end of the shir. But the Gemara talks about this, actually. The Gemara, that's actually a Mishnah. There's a famous concept in Judaism called Mida Keneged Mida. When Hashem offers a punishment to somebody, so one of the classical ways that Hashem gives a punishment is in accordance with what the sin was. Right? The punishment is going to have some semblance to sin. You know, it's a way of teaching us like what did I do wrong. It's like the punishment is not there, you know, just to like get revenge. The punishment is there to try to help correct you. So if it's trying to help correct you, so one of the helpful ways of helping you fix yourself is if you tell me what's wrong. So one of the mechanisms that Hashem does is when he punishes somebody, he'll punish them in a way that sort of alludes to what they did wrong, right? So the Mishnah brings the Masechta Sota brings a whole bunch of examples of this concept of Mida Keneged Mida. Now this is the source. You ever heard of Mida Keneged Mida? This is the source of Mida Keneged Mida. So the Mishnah says, Shimshon Holach Achar Einov. Shimshon went after his eyes. Lefikach Nikru Plishim Es Einov. Therefore, the Philistines poked out his eyes. Right? That's the Mida Keneged Mida. He went after his eyes. The Gemara explains, right, because all the way back in the first woman that he married, the woman from Timnah, so he says to his father, Kachli ki hi yishara be'enai, because she is straight in my eyes. Right? If you look actually very closely in the Psukim, so you'll see that he uses that expression when he talks about the woman from Timnah. And also he says, when he spoke to her or to her family. It says over there in Perek Yudalid, Pasuk Zayin says Tishar Be'eni Shimshon, and it was right in the eyes of Shimshon. And then again, it says in what we read earlier today, in the beginning of Pasuk in Perek Tes Zayin, when he goes to the prostitute in Aza, it says Vayar Sham Isha Zayna. There he saw a woman, a Zona woman. So again, it has to do with seeing. And so all these cases, the common denominator is him seeing, him using his eyes. So he used his eyes for something wrong, so his punishment is that his eyes get gouged out. The Gemara also says, that it's Rebbe Omer, Tchilas Kilkuloi Ba'aza, Lefikach Loka Ba'aza. The beginning of Shimshon messing up was in Aza, with what we started with today, with him meeting the Zona in Aza, in the city of Gaza. Therefore, he was smitten in the city of Gaza. And we're going to see that in the end, Shimshon is going to die in the city of Gaza. Right? So he messed up, started messing up in Gaza. Therefore, he gets smitten in the city of Gaza. And the Gemara asks a question. Tchilas kilkulei ba'aza. He started messing up in Gaza. So the Gemara asks, really? He started messing up in Gaza? V'haksiv, doesn't it say in the Pasuk, Vayered Shimshon Timnasa? Right? The first Philistine woman that he had relations with was from Timnah. So what do you mean that he started messing up in Gaza? He started messing up in Timnah. So the Gemara says, no. Tchilas kilkuloi mi'a ba'aza. The first woman that he married, for some reason, the Gemara doesn't find that so problematic. But the beginning of his getting messed up was in Aza. So Rashi explains, it's interesting, Rashi, because what Rashi does is he completely ignores the issue of, is she Jewish or not Jewish? Any of these women, were they Jewish or not Jewish? And Rashi says, the first woman, the woman from Timnah, even though she was a Philistine, it wasn't such a problem. Rashi says, love kilkul. Lav kilkul hu kulei hai, wasn't so bad. So he wasn't messing up so bad because he married her. He did it. The Yerushalmi and Saita says it was derech nisuin. It had the outer trappings of a wedding, right? A marriage. It looked like a regular formal relationship. We saw yesterday there was a party like they do when you get married. You make a party, you know, with the best man. So that wasn't so bad. But when he came to Aza, so that was Bala Derech Znus, because she was a prostitute, and he was just hiring her to use her as a prostitute. So that's where Shimshon started messing up. He started messing up in Aza, so he gets punished in Aza. This, whatever he did in Timnah, Rashi says, it was bad, but it wasn't so bad. So Rashi says. Okay. So it says that they captured Shimshon and they made him vayhi teichin bebeis hasurim, and he was grinding in the jail. Right? They made him grind grain while he was working in jail. Right? He was the grinding guy. Chazal tell us. In the Sagas Soita, Daf Yud Amud Aleph, it says, "Mala Amar Rabbi Yochanan, ain tchina ela lashon avera." The word tchina, grinding, really mean grinding. It's an allusion to avera, to a sexual misdeeds. Malamed shekol echad ve'echad hevi lo yis ishta lebeis hasurim kedei shetesaber himenu. This means that all the Philistine guys brought their wives to the jail in order for Shimshon to impregnate their wives.
What? That's crazy.
Right? As we saw yesterday, that the Philistine people were not so loyal to or faithful to marriage, to the institute of marriage as a whole, and they were engaged in wife swapping. Like we said, the Medrash said that Ma, just like their vineyards are klayim, so too their daughters are also klayim. That means that they're built of forbidden mixtures. So you see that the Philistines are sort of, you know, loose about these type of things. So they all brought their wives to Shimshon, who was in jail, and they wanted their wives to become pregnant from Shimshon so that they could have, you know, nice strong kids like Shimshon is.
But they're not, it's not their kids.
But again, what the Philistines were doing was that their wives are anyways hanging out with being with other guys. Right?
Yeah, but
so anyways, like, what were their kids weren't really their kids.
No, but okay.
That's the point.
Like, no.
If your wife is going to cheat on you with some guy, you at least want him to be a strong guy so that the kid.
No, it's different because.
That's how they looked at it.
It's a difference because it's one thing if he's like cheating with somebody else in your tribe. It's like, okay, she's cheating with somebody else in your tribe. It's like, yeah, okay, fine.
Yeah, but you're missing the point that they want him exactly because he's strong.
Right.
They want their child to get his genes.
Yeah, but it's like if
you think of it in modern terms, yeah? So it's like if you're looking for a sperm donor, right? So you want like The Rock to be like your sperm donor, right? You want like a big, strong guy. What?
I don't know if I'd want The Rock to be honest.
Well, not you, but I'm saying like if you were a Philistine woman, it's like that's the type of guy you would be looking for, right? So the Gemara says that they brought their wives to. Slicha, yesh po shiur. Afshar ledaber b'chutz. Bekitzer, Shimshon.
I could have done earlier, but it was
Shimshon. Shimshon, they bring their wives to Shimshon in jail so that he can impregnate their wives. Yeah, question: the Gemara doesn't say what happened. What happened? Did he impregnate them? What did he do with these women? Did they force him to like impregnate them? Could you force him? The Gemara says there's a concept in kisho el midas. A man can only have an erection if his mind is in it. If he wants to, he can have it. You can't force a guy, put a gun to his head and say, okay, you are going to sleep with this person. Unless he wants to do it, he's not going to be able to do it. Just physically doesn't work.
Well,
I don't know. That's an interesting question.
Yeah, and they did have...
What's his question?
He's saying that now that there's such a thing as Viagra, so maybe the concept of En Kisha Elimidas is not necessarily true,
because
you can force a man to fit. You can physically force a man to have an erection, even if his mind is not there.
But not only that, there's also another thing that you could do. I think he knows.
I don't know. I don't want to know what you're talking about.
But you do know.
But
I don't know.
They did used to have what's it called?
Is that what?
They used to have things to make them.
Like aphrodisiacs for men.
Yes, aphrodisiacs.
Yeah, there's such a thing. That yain amoni. There's a medrash that says that when the women of Midian came to try to get the Jewish people to do Baal Peor, so they gave the men yain amoni, ammonite wine, which makes them very aroused. And then there's also a medrash that says that the waters of Shittim turns people on, and so like the Jews you know, strayed with the Benos Moav by Shittim, so that's because the waters of Shittim made them go off. I don't know. It's an interesting question. Maybe even in these things there's an element of your mind has to be there also. I don't know. Now,
there's another way, but it's very gross.
Okay. Calm down. There is a tradition that says that one of these women that was brought to Shimshon was Orpah. We mentioned Orpah 2 days ago in the story of Ruth. So Ruth and Orpah were both daughters-in-law of Naomi, and they both wanted to go with Naomi back to Eretz Yisrael from Eretz Moav. And in the end, Ruth goes with Naomi, and Orpah doesn't end up going with Naomi. Orpah ends up staying in Moav. Right? And Chazal tell us that night that Orpah stayed in Moav, so she was involved in some sort of orgy with 100 men and one dog, and from that Goliath was born. There's such a chazal. So there's another tradition that's also in the Tosefta de Targum and Rav Shalom Shabazi and the Chasam Sofer bring this down also, that there's a tradition that says that Orpah actually was one of these women that was with Shimshon when he was in jail, and from that she became pregnant and Goliath was born. So
this is all before King.
Yeah, this is all before King. Yeah.
Before any king.
So this is Goliath. So this is Goliath is born, you know, from. According to this tradition, he's born from Shimshon and Orpah.
Wait, but the Beis HaMikdash then isn't even around.
What? This is the time of the Mishkan, the time of Mishkan Shiloh. Yeah. So it's like, you know, Goliath is like, you know, the big show, or like Andre the Giant, like this huge, strong fellow that he was. No one was able to defeat him until David Melch was able to came along to defeat him. But Chazal in Bamidbar Rabbah in Parsha Chaf Beis compare Goliath to Shimshon, and they point out, they say that Chazal say that there were two Giborim Shomdu Ba'olam, there were two very strong people who came in the world, Goliath from Ummas Ha'olam, from the Gentiles, and Shimshon amongst the Jewish people, and both of them were Nevdu Min Ha'olam, both of them were just completely destroyed from the world. Okay, so let's go. Let's continue with the story of Shimshon. What happens next? So it says that after they had captured Shimshon, so the Philistine noblemen decided, now that we've captured Shimshon, we're going to make a big party, we're going to make a holiday, we're going to bring sacrifices to our gods, and we're going to parade Shimshon around in our idolatrous temple, and we're going to show everybody how we've succeeded and how we've eliminated this threat from the Jews, and we've really subdued the Jews and conquered them and put them under our dominion. So they gathered in the temple of Dagon. Dagon is the Philistine god. Some say that the word Dagon is related to the word Dag, fish, because the idol was in the form of a fish, or because they worshipped the Pisces, which is the mazel of Dagim, associated with the month of Adar. Some say that the form of the idol of Dagon was half person, half fish. So wasn't it completely a fish? It was like some sort of merm person.
Top half was bottom half fish. Or was it like split down
the I don't remember. I have to look. I don't remember if they talk about it. I speak about it. If they speak about it, it's in my book. But God versus Gods, Judaism in the Age of Idolatry. Mosaica Press 2018, for sale for only 85 shekel.
On Amazon?
On Amazon, it's like $27. The cheapest seller. Some say that Dagon was in the form of a mouse. Some academic scholars want to say that Dagon is related to the word Dagan, which is grain, and it was like some sort of god of like fertility of grain and growth and stuff like that. Okay. There's also in Ugaritic, Ugarit was a city in modern-day Lebanon, where they found a lot of mythological writings. So in their mythological Canaanite writings, it says that Baal, the Canaanite god Baal, was a son of Dagon. So like there's, you know, they're all mixed in with each other. Anyway, so they bring Shimshon to make the sacrifice for Dagon, and they're all gathered up, and they say, Nosan Eloheinu biyadeinu es oyveinu, our God put in our hands our enemy, ve'es machriv arzenu, and the one who's destroyed our land, v'asher hirbe es chalaleinu, and the one who had proliferated our dead bodies. And they were all happy, and they started, you know, playing with Shimshon, and they're making a mockery of him. Ah, the poor strong Shimshon with his eyes gouged out. And what do? They put him in between these two pillars in the temple of Dagon. They stood him up in between the two pillars. He was chained down with the pillars, right? And now, one thing that we forgot to mention is that the pasuk very like nonchalantly mentions that Shimshon's hair started growing back a little bit. Okay, now according to what we said before, the hair is not the make it or break it. Whether he has the hair or he doesn't have the hair, that's not the main source of Shimshon's power, right? It's not just hair, right? It's not all about the hair. You tell that to Donald Trump, right? It's not all about the hair.
But he started gaining his strength.
What? Is what?
He started gaining his strength back.
So he's in this temple, and he's chained up to the two pillars that are holding up the whole thing. And it's tons of people over here. It says that there were 3,000 people on the roof, and just on the roof watching it. And Chazal in Bereishis Rabba, Parshat Tzadik Ches, say that it wasn't 3,000 people on the roof. It was 3,000 people on the edge of the roof that, like, if you were looking up from down, you could see 3,000 people. But on the roof, there were even more than 3,000 people behind them. Right? And then in the courtyard itself, there were tons and tons of people. Right? And Shimshon realizes this is his chance to make his last stand. Vayikra Shimshon al Hashem vayayimar. Shimshon called out to Hashem and he said, Hashem Elokim, Hashem, Hashem the God, Zochreinina, remember me, V'chazkenina, and strengthen me, Achapamazeh, just this one time, Achapamazeh Elokim, just this one time, O Hashem, V'nokmo nikam achas, b'shtei enayim b'plishim, and I'll get one, with one act of revenge, I will avenge both my eyes from what the plishim did to me. Famous song, like, what's his name? What's Shlomi saying from Dov Shurin? My wife, for some reason, doesn't like that song because of what's about to happen to Shimshon, I guess. So it's not such a happy song. Shimshon is basically going on a kamikaze mission.
Yeah.
He realizes that he can take down a lot of Plishti people if he brings down the pillars of this temple. And the whole building collapses, so he'll die, but tons of Plishtim will die as well. So he says the famous last words, "Tamus nafshi im plishtim." My soul will die with the Plishtim. The Gemara uses this as like a person who's willing to mess over somebody else, even if it's at his own expense. So Gemara calls it "Tamus nafshi im plishtim." Let my soul die with the Plishtim. Like I don't care that I'm messing myself over as long as I screw you over also. Right. No, that's what the expression means.
Right.
And it says that he leaned with his force and he knocked down the pillar and the entire building collapsed and there were more people that died in this one incident than Shimshon had killed in his entire life. So Shimshon created this massacre over here by giving up his life for Hashem. Now, when Shimshon says Zachreinina, the Medrash says, and it's also the Gemara actually says this also. What's he saying? Hashem, remember me. Remember me? Like, remember you, the guy who slept with, like, the three Philistine women, the guy who's, like, not doing the right thing? Like, what's the remember me? So the Gemara and the Medrash say that when he says Zochreinina, he means, remember me, that all 20 years that I was a judge over the Jewish people, I never inconvenienced anybody. I never asked somebody, I never took advantage of my leadership position and ask somebody to, like, oh, could you get me my stick, my walking stick? Can you bring it from here to here? Just do me a favor. I never took advantage of my position to, you know, push people into doing things for me. I didn't do it for myself. I was sort of altruistic in that way. So that's what it means. Zachrein, you know, remember that zchus that I have, that I never took advantage of my position as the shofet. And Hashem, it seems, agreed with that, and Hashem gave him the power. You know, he turned into the Hulk again. He was able to bring down these two pillars, brought down the whole building, and he killed a bunch of Philistine people with him. And then it says that afterwards his brothers and his father came and they took out his body and they buried him between Sarah and Eshtael in his family's, you know, in the cemetery where his family is buried. And it says the last words are V'hu shafat es Yisrael esrim shana. And Shimshon judged the Jewish people for 20 years. So it's funny because at the end of Parak Tzvav, we already said that Shimshon judged the Jewish people for 20 years. And now here at the end of it, we said, usually that happens at the end of the story where it says how many years he judged. And then there was in the middle of the story. And now here at the end of the story again, it says, oh, he judged the Jewish people for 20 years. So what's up with that? So Chazal tell us that it's to allude to the fact that there were two sets of 20 years that Shimshon brought salvation to the Jewish people. There were the 20 years where he was alive, where he was beating up Plishtim and, you know, helping out the Jews and you know, helping them assert their...
He was 20?
No, that's all we said. We didn't say that. We said that he was judged for 20 years. So the 20 years that he was alive as the, let's say, functioning as the judge, as the leader, so he was in this position. But then after he died, so it says that the fear of Shimshon was upon the Philistines. They were so scared that maybe there's going to be another Jewish guy like Shimshon who's also very strong, that for 20 years after Shimshon died, the Plishtim didn't start up with the Jewish people so much. So it says that the Jews were under Plishti rule for 40 years. So 20 of those years was, you know, under Shimshon's leadership, and 20 of those years was after Shimshon died. But for 20 years after he died, they were still scared of the Jews, that they didn't mess too much with them. Bo, what are you saying?
Reminds me of Baruch Marzel, who was just banned from the Knesset.
Yeah, he says that his good friend, the guy who went on the shooting spree.
Baruch Goldstein, yeah.
His good friend Baruch Goldstein, when he said he claims that after he killed all the Muslims in Marshallville, just for 4 years after, there's not a single attack on a Jewish ever. That's a big price.
Could be. So that's Shimshon, our 13th judge. What time is it?
It's way past.
Way past?
Yeah, it's 4:53.
Okay, so we're going to stop over here.
What time was it meant to end?
You don't want to know.
It was 4:30, wasn't it?
So we're going to stop over here, and we're going to speak more about Shimshon and the connection between Shimshon and David and the role of what Shimshon could have been and how Shimshon represents Malchus. We're going to speak about that tomorrow. And then tomorrow's our final day. We're going to speak about the judges after Shimshon, Eli Kayin, Shmuel Navi, very, very briefly.
Well, how do you get the strength of Shimon?
1 second.
I mean Shimshon.
And then afterwards we'll give some allusions to different shoftim that we find in the Torah, in Yaakov Avinu's brachas that he gave to the different tribes. So we find hints to Gidon, to Yiftach, to Shimshon. Like we mentioned earlier, Dan, Yodin, Amay, we'll explain that a little bit more at length, and at Devorah. So we'll try to do all of that tomorrow. Yeah, Shimshon is from Shevet Dan. Okay. Thank you for coming, and thank you for staying.
A gentleman, one announcement.